After he was disowned, he joined up with the Episcopal Church, the Anglican Church, and they promptly sent him back to America to be their missionary to convert Quakers to Anglicanism. And for a couple of years he traveled up and down. He left a very interesting journal of traveling in America from Maine to Carolina, and describing what he found and how terribly strong the Quakers were and how ignorant everybody else was, and the church ought certainly to send some missionaries over here to save the people, both the Quakers and the unchurched people, from their evil ways. Well, if you look up his writings, you'll find some of them are on arithmetic and geography, and some are on Quakery. And the longest group are those he wrote when he'd been gotten into trouble with the Quakers and wrote against the Quakers. Pro-Quaker, anti-Quaker, and neutral, shall I say, the three classes of his writing. Now a word about Robert Barclay. His last name must be familiar to most of you in this room. He represents another trained and educated Scotch Quaker. He comes from a rather good family. I guess the only family I know that was really related to the royal family of England, the Stuarts. His mother was third cousin to James the First, if that, something like that, never mind. But there was that kind of distant relationship. You may remember the Stuarts came from Scotland also. His father is worth noticing. His father's name was David Barclay, and they both lived in an estate in turn, which is called Ury, U-R-Y. Here are some pictures of it, which you can pass around. This hall has been torn down in more recent years, but those are taken fairly recently enough to show you what it looked like. This was a manor house with grounds about it, something like Swarthmore, and it came down the family until David Barclay and his son Robert were the heirs and residents here. His father, by the way, had been a soldier in the wars before this, and he fought on the king's side, one of the few men that fought on the king's side that became Quakers. He was imprisoned in 1664 for having served also in the Commonwealth as a civil officer. I think he was a member of Parliament. And in prison he was converted by a fellow prisoner. I wish there were no doubt be plenty of Quakers in the same prison. And while he was in prison and converted, his son came to see him, Robert, and he was converted to Quakerism, or convinced, when he was about 18 years old. He had been educated in a theological college, a Roman Catholic theological college in Paris, and also had read a great deal, self-educated besides. For 10 years he was largely occupied in controversial speaking and writing, and had a good deal in common with Keith. I mentioned one episode where they were together, this debate. They were in prison together, they traveled in the missionary work together, they both went to Europe together with others, as you remember, and he married an Aberdeen girl. He formed a close friendship with another very prominent woman, the Princess Elizabeth in the Palatine, who was a cousin of his, and some of his best writing and letters to those. He also had an American connection. In 1682, he was appointed governor of East Jersey, same province that where Keith was surveyor. But he was non-resident governor, never came over. And as you see, he died in 1690 at the age of 42. Some would say that he died too young and that Keith lived too long. If Keith had died in 1690, there had never been any black mark against him from the Quaker point of view. They were both going strong in 1690. His most important influence is to be found in a book he wrote called The Apology for the True Christian Divinity. It goes by the name of Apology. You understand the Apology is not, as we often use today, it is a defense. It's not an admission of wrong. In any sense, it is a defense. That's the old meaning of the word, Greek and Latin word, apologia. And this was published in Latin in 1676, as such a learned book ought to be, and translated into English in 1678. And it's become a classic in Quaker religion, the only classical theological exposition of Quakers. This is the book of reference, has been until recently, for anyone who wanted to know what Quakerism stood for. You look it up in the Apology and you get the official answer. Of course, it was reprinted. The English was reprinted. I think there are 30 editions of this book in the Hereford collection over here. And it was translated into the modern languages, I think, including Arabic, at any rate, into Danish and Swedish and French and German and Italian, and so on. So it was a very influential book. In reading it, and you'll be reading selections from it quite briefly, you want to remember that Barclay aimed only to deal with those points where Quakers differed from other Christians. Now, you may say there's another whole area of agreement between Quakerism and Christianity. But this book was to deal with the points where the Quakers differed from other Christians. In belief and in practice, some of the things that William Penn mentioned in the practice of the Quakers, war and oaths and so on, he deals very thoroughly with those. But he also deals with such questions as the inner life, Christ, the scriptures, predestination, election, free will, others, the controversial matters which they had to deal with. I won't say more about him today except to introduce him in this way. And I think you'll see that his answers to and explanations of Quakerism are based upon the philosophy of his time. And he and his opponents have in common points of view which the modern intellectual world has largely outgrown. It makes him as unsatisfactory today. Since the rise of natural science, since the rise of modern psychology, since the modern historical view of the Bible, almost as unsatisfactory as his opponents. But what can you expect? And what do you expect of any modern book that tries to explain Quakerism, except that it also should be limited by the framework of thought of our period? However, it was an influential work, an eloquent work. He's addicted to the logical method in the most rigid way, which perhaps is all right if you're going to argue. You wouldn't like to debate against him on anything, I think, because he He understood the logic. But as I've said, the assumptions which both he and his opponents had are unsatisfactory. He has to have recourse to miracle to have any relation between God and man. Well, that's enough on that. If you want some books, I have some here. We'll turn to our quiz. I want to remind you that Monday is the day the paper is due.